welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington on this pre-recorded program. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Friday, June 19, 2020. A South Sudanese analyst says the continuous rebellion in South Sudan is a sign that people are not happy.
Because of the kind of the political environment that exists in the country, an environment which does not allow free speech and does not allow open criticism of the government, and critics finding themselves behind bars or disappeared, leaving very little room for would-be government critics.
And the UN Refugee Agency says South Sudanese are returning home in big numbers.
South Sudan government's Relief and Rehabilitation Commission with UNHCR and the partners have verified that around 9,600 refugees have returned to South Sudan in a self-organized manner.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. A South Sudanese policy analyst says the killing of the leader of the 7th October movement is not the end of rebellion in the country. Jock Madud Jock, who is also a professor of anthropology at the University of Syracuse in the United States, says Carbino Wall's attempt to rise against the government was what Jock calls an indication that Wall was oppressed and could not express himself. Jock says Wall's rebellion against the government indicates ongoing frustrations among South Sudanese due to the government's suppression of people's rights. For VOA News, Wake Simon Udu reports from Juba.
Professor Jock Madud Jock says Carbino Wall's decision to lead a rebellion against the government and his subsequent killing by the government forces should send a signal to the government that South Sudanese feel their rights are being suppressed. Jock says he was not surprised when Wall announced he was taking up arms against the government. He says he thinks Wall was pushed to the brink because he could not find a space to address the injustices he and others might have suffered.
He could not find any other way to express the ghastly injustice that was meted out against him and against many others over the years.
South Sudanese military spokesperson Major General Lulu Roy Kwang said government forces killed Wall in Lake State on Sunday evening. He said on Monday that government forces tracked down Wall after he announced the formation of his rebel group. Wall told this program 2 weeks ago he wanted to overthrow the government to get rid of what he called the existing injustices in the country and to restore peace and stability. In Wall's manifesto, he called for the removal of South Sudan's current system of government and its leadership. He called it a failed government and leadership which breeds poverty, famine, environmental devastation, and atrocities. Jock says Wall's rebellion was a more concentrated moment after years of frustration with the government.
Especially on the issues of civil rights, rule of law, and state violence. This means that Wall's death will not mark an end to the phenomenon of rebellion as a means to achieving political objectives. On the contrary, it speaks to a strong likelihood that his death will trigger more rebellions, or at least a more concerted and popular opposition to Kiir's government.
Like other rebellions, Jock says, Wall formed his movement to achieve justice and to improve the country's system of government for others.
It was simply following in the direction that the country has been on for nearly 30 years, the direction being that people see arms and rebellion as a way to achieve political objectives because of the kind of the political environment that exists in the country, an environment which does not allow free speech and does not allow open criticism of the government, and critics finding themselves behind bars or disappeared.
South Sudan in Focus contacted Information Minister Michael Makwey, who also doubles as the government spokesperson, to comment on this story, and here is what he said.
I'm sorry, I don't have any knowledge of what you are talking about.
Jock says he does not think Kerbino Walls' October 7 movement will be the last rebellion mounted against the South Sudan government. For VOA News, I'm Waki Simon Wudu in Juba.
The United Nations mission in South Sudan says the patterns and the escalation of intercommunal violence in Jonglei State is worrying. Alfred Zulu, the human rights officer for the UN mission in South Sudan field office in Bor, says armed men attacked Pakwach Panyam near the UNMISS compound in Bor last night, killing scores of civilians and injuring others. Mabior Atem, the Jonglei State Acting Administrator, says armed men suspected to be from the Greater Pibor Administrative Area killed 9 people, injured 2 others, and abducted 2 women and a child. Dengai Deng reports for VOA from Bor.
44-year-old eyewitness Chola Lirmaj says a group of about 50 armed men in mixed military uniforms attacked Makwach Payam of Bor County last night. He's speaking in Dinka. Maj says the uniformed men shot him in the chest.
These armed men surrounded the village, and when I and another person came back after we went to tour the porters, they started by shooting us, and I was the first to be shot. And that's how the fighting started. If they see you, then many people chase after you until they catch and kill you. There were no cattle there. There were only goats, but they didn't take the goats. I think they came only to kill people.
Bole Chow, the director of Bor State Hospital, says 2 people injured in last night's attacks in Makwach are being treated at the hospital for gunshot wounds.
2 adult males were brought last evening from Makwach. One had a fractured forearm bones, and then one had a retained bullet to the abdomen. He was just the one with the retained bullet in the abdomen was just taken to the theater where the bullet was removed and is now back in the ward. I think with time, because of the effect of anesthesia, it will just his condition will stabilize.
The human rights officer at the UNMISS field office in Bor, Alfred Zulu, says intercommunal violence is escalating in the area.
Abduction of women and children is a common practice in this area, has been going on for generations, but we need to stem it, we need to stop it. And it's a violation of the rights of the children, it's a violation of the rights of the women. They are traumatized, they are taken to where they do not know, they lose their identity, they lose contact with family, some of them are tortured, others are abused.
Jonglei State Acting Administrator Mabiura Tim says armed youth from the Greater Pibor Administrative Area killed 9 people, injured 3 others, and abducted 2 women and a girl.
A group of youth, whom the local authorities believe to be coming from Buma State, came to Makwach Payam and they attacked the town. And as a result, they had killed so far 9 people. The breakdown of those who were killed, there were 7 women and 2 men. And they also abducted 1 child and 3 were wounded in the area.
Zulu says human rights violations have occurred repeatedly in the area, especially against women and children in Jonglei State, following intercommunal violence in Pibor and Jonglei. Zulu is calling on the state authorities to improve its protections of civilians.
We heard yesterday and we saw the fracas in Makwach, which is near UNMISS compound. There were gunshots and villagers, women and children were scuttling in different directions. Later we learned that an armed gang of Mole armed men invaded the area and they killed, as far as we know up to now, 10 people. And they wounded others. Those wounded were in hospital at Bor. And this is worrying us a lot because just the day before, which is the 17th, there was another attack in Jalei where also 10 people were killed and 9 others were injured. So this pattern of attack is seriously worrying us. And this intercommunal fighting is escalating.
Jonglei State Police Commissioner Major General Joseph Mayana Kon says the police are doing what they can to protect Bor Town.
Anybody who aim to attack the cities are rebels. Civilians cannot attack the government cities. But we warn those people not to do that. So we, the security in Botown, all of us, we are ready. We are ready, even the army, to protect the installation.
Judy Jonglei Boyoris, the former speaker of the now defunct Burma State, told South Sudan in Focus yesterday he has no information of the attacks in Bor, but said some armed Murley youth could have gone to Bor to carry out revenge attacks due to the fighting in Pibor. Local officials say armed youth suspected of being from the Greater Pibor administrative area killed 9 villagers, injured scores of others and stole thousands of cattle on Wednesday night in Pamom Cattle Camp in Akwa Edeng village of Bor County. For VOA News, I am Deng Haideng in Bor.
The UN Refugee Agency and South Sudan Relief and Rehabilitation Commission says South Sudanese refugees are returning to the country despite restrictions on cross-border movements imposed to prevent the spread of COVID-19. UNHCR spokesperson in South Sudan says within April and May, more than 9,000 refugees returned to South Sudan in an organized way from Ethiopia, Sudan, and the Central African Republic. UNHCR says the refugees are returning home because of the high cost of living in host countries like Sudan. For VOA News, Ding Magod reports from Juba.
Julia Raffaelli, the UNHCR spokesperson in South Sudan, says despite government directives and border closures to prevent the spread of COVID-19, South Sudanese refugees continue to spontaneously return to South Sudan on their own volition.
South Sudan government's Relief and Rehabilitation Commission with UNHCR and the partners have verified that around 9,600 refugees have returned to South Sudan in a self-organized manner during April and May, with around 5,000 returns in April and about 4,600 in May. This, of course, from neighboring countries.
Raffaelli says the refugees have returned home over the past 3 months because of the high cost of living in host countries like Sudan, insecurity in host countries, and improved security in parts of South Sudan. She says some refugees told UNHCR they returned to South Sudan because they feared contracting the coronavirus and because schools were closed.
The refugee returnees have indicated, especially among students, following the closure of the schools, they decided to come back to stay with their families. Of course, the closure of schools in neighboring and asylum countries, the fear for a COVID-19 outbreak in the refugee camps and the other housing areas in the country of asylum, coupled with a relatively low number of confirmed cases in South Sudan.
Raffaelli says the biggest number of returnees are from Ethiopia, but specifically those from the Gambela region who moved through Boma, Pochala, and Magnenis to Jonglei State. A huge number of former refugees also came from Sudan through Raja, Gok Machar, and Panakwach to northern Barkazal and Unity States. She says some former refugees returned from the Central African Republic and the Democratic Republic of Congo through South Sudan's Western Equatoria state due to the increased activities of armed elements in those countries. Julia Raffaelli says refugees have spontaneously returned to South Sudan since November 2018 after South Sudan warring parties signed the peace deal.
By May 2020, nearly 169,000 South Sudanese refugees have returned to South Sudan following the signing of the revitalized peace agreement in October 2018. This brings up the total of spontaneous return of refugees since November 2017 to nearly 290,000.
Although South Sudanese refugees in neighboring countries have the right to return, Raffaelli says the system is not conducive to supporting large spontaneous returns, and this might not be the best time to return due to the coronavirus. UNHCR also says years of conflict and floods have left many internally displaced persons, refugees, and host communities struggling to meet their necessary needs. With World Refugee Day tomorrow, Raffaelli notes South Sudan has the largest number of refugees who have sought asylum in other countries. She says it is also a host country for refugees seeking asylum.
The South Sudan refugee crisis remains the largest in Africa, with more than 2 million South Sudanese refugees sheltered mainly in Uganda, Sudan, Ethiopia, and Kenya. As per South Sudan, the country hosts more than 300,000 refugees, predominantly from Sudan, 93% of them, followed by people from DRC, which is the 5%, Ethiopia, Central African Republic, and 300 individuals from other nationalities.
UNHCR says South Sudan has set an example during the COVID-19 crisis by allowing asylum seekers from the DRC and Central African Republic to seek refuge inside its borders. For VOA News, I am Ding Magot in Juba.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, when will scientists come out with a vaccine for the coronavirus? Stay tuned for an answer to that question after this break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what is the funniest thing to ever happen to you?
I was thinking I can cross a gutter. Unfortunately, I found myself in the gutter and everybody was laughing.
The funniest thing to ever happen to me was when I fell down in the marketplace and people were laughing. It became funny to me because I just slipped.
A lot has happened to me, but what I remember, being with my family, discussing, they get to tell me funny stories that make me happy.
The funniest thing that has ever happened to me is moving from the house, picking a vehicle, realizing I don't have money on me. How embarrassing to realize there's nothing on me, just moving out like that.
Try to like ask somebody for money and I tried to like fix something and it didn't work. Well, I was ashamed.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
This is a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
Hello, I'm VOA Health Correspondent Linor Moudou. The World Health Organization and U.S. Centers for Disease Control say coughing and sneezing can spread COVID-19. Physical distancing, staying at least 1 meter away from people outside your family, can protect everyone. For more information, check with reliable sources such as the WHO and Africa CDC. And remember to listen to VOA for the latest on COVID-19.
That was a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. The Sudanese Center for Statistics Bureau has released an inflation report of the country for the month of May. The report says the rate of inflation increased by 114% compared to 99% in April this year. The report says the increase is due to high prices of basic commodities and housing within the past few months. Most Sudanese living in Khartoum say they have been experiencing hardships over the past few months. For VOA News, Michael Atid reports from Khartoum.
Sudan's inflation rate jumped 114.23% in May due to high rising food prices, according to the Bureau's latest report. The report comes more than a year after the country was rocked by protests sparked by bread price hikes. In April, the inflation rate shot up nearly 99% due to increased prices of grains, meat, milk, and bread, according to the Sudanese Central Bureau of Statistics. The report also says inflation in rural areas was up to 127.38% in May, compared to 107% in April 2020. Last week, the U.S. dollars was selling at 130 Sudanese pounds in the black market, while the central bank formally set its price at 55 pounds per dollar. Muhammad Al-Nair, a Sudanese economist who works as an associate professor at Sudan's University in Khartoum, says he is not surprised with the current inflation rate. Speaking in Arabic, he says, given the fact that the country has been in a lockdown for more than 3 months due to COVID-19 pandemic, prices soared.
The country has been under lockdown for the past 3 months or so, which has heavily affected the prices of basic commodities. Economic activities have been on hold, which has also affected the production of commodities, including medicines, and it is becoming a big problem.
The Sudanese pound continues to lose values against foreign currencies. Al Nair says the transitional government is not doing enough to reform the economic sector 9 months after the new government was formed.
The transitional government would have begun already to focus on agricultural production, animal production, and the industrial sector. They would have also focused on scientific research to boost production in the country. All this would have helped in sustaining the prices and maintain the rate of the local currency.
Resident of Al-Kamlin town of Al-Jazira state, Muada Hatim, says it has been hard to provide a daily meal for her family since her work has been affected with the lockdown. Speaking to South Sudan in Focus via WhatsApp from Al-Kamlin, Hatim says the skyrocketing inflation rate has affected thousands of families across Sudan.
If you're not in a governmental job, you're going to lose your salary, so you'll be technically sitting doing absolutely nothing, and you don't have income, and you have now to put more much more outcome, and that affected a lot of people.
Despite Sudan's political transition, which has raised hopes for more reforms, the economy remains in deep crisis. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Khartoum.
The World Health Organization reports research and development of drugs and vaccines for the treatment and prevention of COVID-19 is moving ahead. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
With more than 8 million reported cases of coronavirus, including nearly 500,000 deaths, countries worldwide are desperate for a vaccine that will end the pandemic. The World Health Organization reports rapid progress toward this end, but says there still are several hurdles to overcome before a safe, efficacious vaccine is available. WHO Chief Scientist Soumya Swaminathan tells VOA at least 200 vaccine candidates are at some stage of development. She says about 10 candidates are being tested on humans and 3 will be ready to enter phase 3 clinical trials in a couple of weeks.
So we're entering a new phase now of vaccine trials, the phase 3 trials, which are the ones that will definitively prove whether a vaccine is efficacious and safe. I'm hopeful, I'm optimistic, but vaccine development is a complex undertaking. It comes with a lot of uncertainty.
Swaminathan says people should not lose hope if these trials fail. She notes there are many other vaccine candidates and platforms moving through the clinical trial process.
If we are very lucky, there will be one or two successful candidates before the end of this year. But till we see the results of those trials, and the trials are also difficult to do because you have to do them in places where there's infection going on. So, for example, if you have a country that's developed a vaccine, but they've been able to control their infection rates, they necessarily have to look for other places for testing.
While the search for a preventative vaccine goes on, there have been some promising results in the drug treatment of COVID-19. Clinical trials have shown that remdesivir, a drug used for Ebola, can shorten the recovery time for some coronavirus patients. An anti-inflammatory drug, dexamethasone, appears to reduce death in a significant number of severely ill patients. The drug, which has been around for a long time, is cheap and affordable for the poorest people. Clinical trials on the anti-malaria drug hydroxychloroquine have shown to have no benefits and in some cases could cause death among those infected with coronavirus. However, scientists believe the drug may be effective in the prevention of the disease. Large-scale clinical trials are now underway to see whether this is indeed the case. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Student Students at some South African most elite schools are demanding racial change in the wake of worldwide protest over racial inequality. Former students at some of the nation's best schools say venerated institutions remain steeped in racism and discriminates against non-white students. Anita Paul spoke to some of these students and reports for VOA from Johannesburg.
Worldwide protests against racial inequality have also raised protests at some of Africa's most exclusive schools, where students say entrenched racism and apartheid-era thinking still thrive. Two top-tier private schools in South Africa, St. Anne's and Bishop's Colleges, have grabbed local headlines after current and former students launched campaigns demanding change. At St. Anne's, a girls' school in KwaZulu-Natal province, graduates compiled a long list of racial incidents, from overt racism to acts of microaggression, and are demanding, among other things, more diversity in the student body, staff, and board. These elite boarding schools charge up to $16,000 a year. That, according to government statistics, is how much an average South African earns in a year. At many of these schools, students of color are a minority, although about 80% of the country's population is black. 19-year-old Bonolo Mokoka, a St. Anne's graduate now in her first year of university, says while she's grateful for the academic experience, that doesn't mean she and other black graduates shouldn't challenge the school.
My parents worked hard for me to go to St. Anne's, and I should be grateful to them that I'm going to St. Anne's, but I don't have to be grateful to any of my white counterparts that I went to St. Anne's. It's not like I'm not there because of them. And I think what we're doing now is because we want it to be a better place for our children and a better place for the students that are still going to go into St. Anne's. And black people deserve to have good education and deserve to be treated equally as well. So like, you shouldn't have to choose one or the other.
Leadership at St. Anne's told VOA that they were conducting a commission of inquiry and were unable to comment at this time. Sudutso Ngubane, who was St. Anne's deputy head girl in 2016, said these graduates, who call themselves old girls, were inspired and empowered by worldwide protests against racism.
We are old girls, but what kind of old girls are we if when someone asks us, are you going to send your child to that school? And our first answer is no, there's a problem. So we need to change that. We're doing this now because obviously what's happened in America has raised a lot of questions in South Africa. And one of the main questions was racism in private schools.
At Bishop's College, a Cape Town boys' school, a group of senior students are demanding full scholarships for the children of ground staff, for more discussions of inclusion, and for safe spaces for sexual minorities. Final year student Adam Mutalo, who is 17, says the demands are an inevitable result of their rigorous education.
It's very interesting how they've really taught us like critical thinking skills and how to voiced our opinions very well, and now it seems that we've kind of used that against them, which I find a bit ironic. If we look at the after effects of apartheid, which was many, many years ago, you would expect a lot of change to have occurred within institutions like Bishop's by now, and there really hasn't been major change.
Adam's father, Mohammed Mutala, says he is frustrated that this generation is experiencing some of the same pain and injustice that he did under apartheid. In 1980, Mutala led a walkout at his high school, which was segregated by race. He says he's in awe of this generation.
How they're pushing the boundaries and around white fragility, supremacy, weaponizing white fragility and, you know, implicit racism, and they just don't stand up for it now. And I think we sort of let a lot of that slip for the sake of wanting to build a broader sort of alliances. I'm learning from him.
In a statement, Bishop's administration told VOA that they, too, commend the mature leadership of their students and the unity that they have shown in speaking out together as one. They say they'll address the issue when school holidays end in a few weeks. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
That's our show for this Friday. We now leave you with a traditional song from Lake States. We've been listening to a traditional song from Lake State. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for making us part of your evening. Remember to wash your hands with soap, practice social distancing, and do not escape from COVID-19 quarantine centers, because there is no cure for the coronavirus. Join us again next week for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.